Revelation 9 is where we left off last week and where we want to pick up today. And as we look at Revelation 9, we want to remember that there are two big points. John is talking about the unsaved. And sometimes I think as people look at life, they think, well, hey, the unsaved, the unrighteous people, they go through life and they really don't experience too many bad things. They, in some respects, may seem to have a better life than God's people. In Revelation 9, John says, let me tell you how it is. He says, the unsaved have their fair share of problems. They have their fair share of physical problems because they choose sin. That's the emphasis in the first part of the chapter. Well, if the unsaved have problems in the physical realm, and there's also a second area where they experience issues, what do you suspect the second area is going to be? Spiritual issues. So John closes out the chapter basically focusing on this second point. Now, we did read Revelation 9, 1 and 2 last week. Let me kind of highlight a couple things, and then we'll actually start to read the text again. Now, you may remember that we're coming now to the last three trumpets. You should have the sheet that we passed out last week, and that sheet details for you. It gives you kind of a quick summary of the seven seals, the seven trumpets, and then, of course, the seven plagues. And here, as we said, as we're dealing with the last three, an emphasis on what happens to those who follow the devil instead of Jesus. We've talked before about a fraction, the fourth part of man and the third part of man. And it's important for us to remember what those fractions represent. Does anyone recall what the fourth part of man? The physical part. And the third part of man refers to his spiritual part. Maybe an easy way to remember that is we think of God, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, three members of the Godhead. God created man to be with him. Again, three members of the Godhead, the third part of man, the spiritual part of man. We've mentioned the terrible physical and spiritual consequences in this chapter. And we've got the fifth angel. He's sounding his trumpet. He's talking about this star, this evil power, whether that's the devil or something else. We can't be 100% sure, but he's got this star falling to the earth. And there's this key that's given to this evil source, this evil power, perhaps the devil. And then, of course, this key is a key to what? The bottomless pit, or it's a key. Some translations might use the word abyss. And you have this pit opened up, and you have these basically hellish creatures coming out. Now, John does not say that this bottomless pit or this abyss is hell. I do not believe that it is hell. It seems to me that it is either the bad side of Hades that we read about in Luke 16, or maybe a place that's near there or similar to that. We mentioned a little bit about the word abyss. It means bottomless, depth, deep, immeasurable, depth, bottomless pit, the underworld, the abode of demons. Before we actually deal with Revelation 9, I want to go back and look at a couple passages in the life of Christ. Luke chapter 8, verses 30 and 31, and then we'll pick up, and I'll read both of these from Luke chapter 11, verse 24. We've probably read these a lot of times, but maybe not associated when we read them with the information that we have over here in Revelation 9. Luke chapter 8, looking at verses 30 and 31. And Jesus asked him, "What is thy name?" And he said, "Legion," for many demons were entered into him. And they entreated him that he would not command them to enter into where? The abyss. The deep. Well, this seems to be the same place as described in Revelation chapter 9. Now, we talked about last week that those in the first century would have been very familiar with furnaces because of, you know, processing limestone back then, and you've got these great billows of smoke and, you know, maybe a sulfur-like smell. So whatever is in this place, it's so unpleasant that the demon said, "Hey, wherever you send us, don't ship us back there. We do not want to go there." So demons are apparently familiar with this place, and it's the last place that they want to go. Then one more passage from Luke 11. Verse 24. Now, this may be less directly related, but I still think it's interesting. The unclean spirit, when he's gone out of the man, he passes through waterless places. What's he seeking? Rest. He's seeking rest. Isn't that interesting? Demons seem to be in some kind of state. They seem to have an existence where they're restless. They're looking for some peace and quiet. Well, out of all the places that they can go, where do you think they will not find peace and rest? It's not going to be that abyss. So they've apparently had some very bad, some very negative experiences because of the punishment, and they are looking for a place which is going to be a whole lot more pleasant. Okay, let's read Revelation 9, 1 and 2 again, then we'll make some additional comments and then talk about the locusts. Revelation 9, 1, "And the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star from heaven fallen upon the earth. And there was given to him the key of the pit of the abyss. And he opened the pit of the abyss, and there went up a smoke out of the pit, as the smoke of a great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit. Now, I have to think about the devil and kind of do a quick overview of, you know, where he is and, you know, what's happened to him and what's going to happen in the future. You may remember in Matthew chapter 12, Jesus had the little story about the strong man. And there's the stronger guy that comes and binds him and takes his goods, overpowers him. And that seems to be a reference to Satan. Prior to the coming of Christ, would you say that the devil was pretty strong?
Yeah.
Sure. He might have had, we might say, some extra powers before Jesus came and paid the price for man's sin and then was raised from the dead and so forth. But Jesus, he came, he lived a perfect life, was a perfect sacrifice. And now, because of what the Lord did, there's really been a judgment that's fallen on Satan. Now, there's kind of a balance here. The Lord has done all those things, but at the same time, Satan still has a kingdom. Colossians 1, verse 13. We also find that he is extremely dangerous. Remember 1 Peter 5:8, the devil is compared to a roaring lion. So even though Jesus has knocked him down several pegs, he's still dangerous. But that danger is really to those who will not resist him. James 4, verse 7, resist the devil and he's going to flee from you. So it is possible, and we also think about the fact that we have the key in Revelation 9, verse 1. So Satan's not able to do all that he might like to do. We also think about Jesus prior to a sacrifice. Were people inhabited by demons? They were possessed. And in some cases, a person was not possessed by just one demon, but they were possessed by multiple demons. So prior to Jesus' sacrifice, people were having a lot of difficulties with the devil. Now, John in Revelation 9 is in some respects picturing Satan as bound. Now, you will find a little bit later in the book, and we may reference this at various times, people understand this differently, but in Revelation 20, verse 3, we're probably familiar with this, and cast him into the abyss. Well, there's that pit again. And shut it and sealed it over him that he should not deceive the nations for how long? Until 1,000 years are finished. So, without going off on a big tangent, it seems to me that Satan, sometime before the Lord returns, towards maybe what we might say the end of the Christian dispensation, Satan is going to be given additional authority again. It sounds to me like he's going to have kind of one last chance. You know, people say you've got one more shot at this. God says, I'm going to give you one more shot shortly before the Lord comes to go out and you can just throw everything that you've got. I don't think that means, you know, that demons are going to inhabit people again, but you're going to have a lot more increased authority, increased power to go and try to sweep the world one last time. And then when you've had that, then it's going to be time for the Lord to return and to completely end things. As Satan is waging that battle, we do have some promises that are good promises. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13, God says, there has no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man, and you can bear it. So once again, the devil is out there. He's active throughout the world, but God says, at least for the Christian, we've got some things that are going to temper that. Scott?
So after Satan,
it seems to me, yes, that you have the picture of the first seal Jesus is going through. He's gleaned the world. And, you know, at that time, you still have some Christians. You still have some people who are not accountable. And Satan, like I say, has that one last attempt. So, yes, you're exactly right. Bonnie?
What did you mean by the end of the Christian dispensation?
Okay. When we think about this year, 2012, we have 365 days in the year. We're now towards the end of the year. When we think about it, it'll still be the Christian dispensation. I'm not saying that there's going to come some extra time. But we don't know, but let's say that the world ends, and this is just a big for instance, let's say that the world's going to end in 2100. Maybe for the last 50 years, or the last 10 years, the last year, during that time, Satan will, in my understanding, be allowed to go ahead and really ramp things up for his kingdom. But
just... You don't think he's constantly doing that?
I do think he's doing that. He's doing as much as he can. But in Revelation 23, where John says he's going to be loosed at the end of the 1,000 years...
But that's not a literal 1,000 years.
No, I believe that 1,000 years describes a whole Christian era. And when we get to the end of the 1,000 years, that's the end of the Christian age. That's when Christ returns.
Right.
But sometime shortly before Jesus returns, whether that's a day or a month or a year or whatever it is, Satan seems to be able to at that time have some additional things that he can do. But he's already able to wreak a lot of havoc right now. So, maybe we can think of it in these terms. When we look at our society right now, do we have a lot of people who are unhappy?
Yeah.
Sure. But did you see the pictures of Greece? You've got unemployment that's over 50% for, you know, the young people. And, you know, they're out rioting in the streets. So, I mean, it's bad here, but we typically don't have buildings being firebombed and people being shot in the streets. So, chaos in both, but it's worse over there. So that would be my illustration for it, Bonnie. But no extra age, no extra dispensation.
Just like the beginning, a little far out. But I guess maybe it's just a curiosity question. If Christ came and because of his sacrifice and everything, the Satan was somewhat limited. We don't know maybe to what extent. But why, towards the end of the Christian dispensation, would he be free to do his
works?
The only answer that I know to give would be to try to draw away God's people.
Is this the only verse that tells us that?
As far as Revelation 23? That, to me, would be the clearest. So we have to understand what the 1,000 years is. There has to be some interpretation for that. And we have tried to go ahead and lay out the framework to say that that seems to refer to the entire Christian dispensation. Now, if that's true, then John seems to be pretty specific as far as saying Satan's going to be loosed at the end of that time. So, let's not get buried on that. We'll pick that up in Revelation 20, but you can kind of think about that. Let's stick here with Revelation chapter 9. We know that the devil's busy, and here I want to make a couple of brief comments about what we said as far as there in verse 2. He opened the pit, and you've got smoke coming up out of the pit. The smoke is like a great furnace. The sun, the air were darkened by reason of the smoke from the pit. Now, when you think about a couple of things, for example, sun and air, they necessary for life?
Yes.
Yeah. And we said before, this was one of the things that we touched on last week, when you have the sun and the air darkened, if that's true, literally, which most of the stuff in the book of Revelation is not literal, you have symbols for various things, what would that do to a lot of people? You foul the air, you darken the sun, alright, we're going to die. So we don't think that that's literal. If it's symbolic or figurative, what do you think John's talking about? All right, evil and darkness. We think about light or air, really from, I believe, the perspective of God's Word. Back in 8:12, he used the image of sun to describe spiritual leaders. The Old Testament, for example, uses God's Word. He illustrates that in places like Psalm 119, verses 105, to compare God's Word to the light. And we think about the Gospel. So the picture is, you want God, righteousness, his light to go throughout the world, but what's the devil doing? You know, you've got these hellish creatures being released, and what's their goal?
Influence.
All right, to influence. And to influence people to not see or not turn to what? The gospel. So this is Satan's basic modus operandi. He wants to go ahead and keep people away from the truth. And like I say, maybe towards the end of the Christian's dispensation, he's going to try to be even more effective in this particular area. We think about 2 Corinthians 4, 3 and 4. Paul talked about the god of this world, Satan. He wants to blind the minds of people. You remember Jesus' parable about the sower, the seeds planted, and Jesus said, what's the devil want to do? He wants to come along and snatch it away. He wants to go ahead and block the sun. He wants to take that air, that spiritual life that we need, and suck it out of the lives of people. So what the Bible talks about in other passages as far as Satan and his work, Paul talked about demonic doctrine, 1 Timothy 4, verse 1. We think about the precepts of men in Matthew chapter 15, verses 8 and 9. So you have all Satan's false ways as being described like thick smoke. People say, well, we can't see because of the smoke. We've got to clear the smoke. We've got to clear the fog away. Well, that's also true in the spiritual realm, isn't it? You have all the false philosophies and all the junk out there that, you know, causes people to have convoluted thinking and so forth. So Satan, this smoke, suggestive, I think, of his worldwide influence and all of the various tricks and schemes that he has. So he's always interested in trying to keep people away from knowing and obeying the truth. Anything that you want to add or ask before we start talking about the locusts? Okay. We have there in verse 3 the information about locusts. Before we read that, I do want to give you a little bit of information about that. The locusts are probably the most important insects in all the Bible. We have a lot of insects mentioned in Scripture, but locusts are very, very important. In fact, if you go back and you study a little bit about locusts, you find that there are 9 different words in the Old Testament that describe locusts. Now, that will kind of tip you off to the fact that, hey, whatever is associated with this creature, it's going to be very, very important. And they are a possible source of protein, but generally when we read about locusts in the Bible, you think it's favorable or unfavorable? All right, it's going to be unfavorable. It's judgment day, judgment time, and not the end of time, but a judgment from God has arrived. We think back to Exodus 10, verses 13 through 15. Was it one of the plagues that God sent upon the Egyptians? Yeah, they had a locust plague. And these are very, very bad. You go back and you do a little reading, or maybe you've seen some pictures. They have the ability to swarm. They have the ability to migrate in some parts of Africa. Can you imagine a 2,000 square area? And they've covered. Locusts just cover the ground. Everywhere you see. I mean, it's just like grass that's extremely thick. Prior to the New Testament era, locusts were one of the biggest problems that people had. Let's go back to the book of Joel for a second. I'll read the first 7 verses and also some information from the second chapter. The word of Joel 1. The word of Jehovah that came to Joel, the son of Pethuel, "Hear this, ye old men, and give ear, all ye inhabitants of the land. Hath this been in your days, or in the days of your fathers? Tell ye your children of it, and let your children tell their grandchildren, and their children another generation." Now, when God says, hey, this is a story that I want you to tell it to the next generation, and the next generation, and the next generation, what's that suggest about the story? This is big, big news. It's very, very important. "That which the palmer worm hath left, the locust eaten, and that which the locust hath left, the cankerworm has eaten, and that which the cankerworm hath left, the caterpillar hath eaten. Awake, ye drunkards, and weep and wail, ye drinkers of wine, because of the sweet wine, for it is cut off from your mouth. For a nation is come up to destroy my land, strong and without number. His teeth are the teeth of a lion. He hath the jaw of a lioness. He hath laid my vine waste, and bark my fig tree. He hath made it clean bare, and cast it away, and branches thereof are made white." And then in the second chapter, "Blow ye the trumpet in Zion, sound an alarm in my holy mountain. Let all the inhabitants of the land tremble, for the day of Jehovah cometh, for it is nigh at hand." It's going to be a day of darkness, gloominess, clouds, thick darkness, as the dawn spread upon the mountains. A great people and strong, there hath not been anything ever like this. A fire devours before them, verse 3, behind them a flame burneth, and land is as the Garden of Eden before them. And then you have in verse 4, and John will pick up this information and imagery in Revelation 9. "The appearance of them is as the appearance of horses, and the horsemen, so do they run. Like the noise of chariots on the tops of the mountains do they leap. Like the noise of a flame of fire that devoureth the stubble. As a strong people set in battle array. And their presence, the peoples, are in anguish. Their faces are waxed pale." And then he talks about the earth quaking before them. In verse 10, "Jehovah uttereth his voice before his army." So as he talks about what was going to happen, compares it to a locust plague, the imagery is very, very bad. There are some other additional references in the Old Testament that show that to get rid of a locust plague, the people had to engage in special days of prayer. There had to be fasting, and there had to be trumpet blowing. We don't have anything that we can look to and compare to. 9/11 doesn't work, but what we see right now going on with the East Coast, you see these people, they're without food, they're without shelter, they're without electricity, and they just feel like everything's been stripped from them. Magnify that times about 100,000. And that's what it would be like to have a locust plague. I mean, they are literally everywhere. So when John uses this particular imagery in the New Testament, that's the Old Testament. And I mean, it's a way of describing a force, a power that's without mercy. And that's why in Joel 1 and Joel 2, God, you know, tries to pull from this imagery of locusts and say, you're going to face absolute devastation. So a figurative reference based on a very terrible insect to communicate some spiritual points. Anything that you want to address before we pick up with Revelation 9:3, Steve?
So this is talking about consequences that they're suffering.
For the unsaved. If you choose to reject God, to destroy that third part, the spiritual part of your life. Now, in this case, you have people that kind of fall into two different categories. You know, some people will not reject the spiritual part of life. What do they do with it? God says you should use it this way. But people will say, well, I'm not going to destroy it. I'm going to...
They're going to mold it to make it what they
want. All right, I'm going to mold it so it works for me. Now, that's not quite what John's describing. John is really describing the people who try to shut down. You think about an atheist, for example, the people who really try to force God out of their lives and the lives of others. And John said, if you make this choice, here are going to be the consequences that you face in life. Now, the other folks that Scott mentioned, they try to take that and, you know, shift that maybe into a form of Christianity, or maybe they go off into a non-Christian, quote-unquote, religion. They're also going to suffer. But specifically here, the people that really try to blot out the spiritual part of their life. But for the unsaved.
This is God's vengeance.
Yes. So you're going to pay not only in eternity, but John in Revelation 9 says you're going to pay in this life as well. Okay, now he says, out of the smoke came forth locusts upon the earth, and power was given them as the scorpions of the earth have power. Now we saw back in Revelation chapter 8, verses 6 and 7, a reference to green grass. And if you remember, how do we describe that grass? Oh, I'm sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. I got off track there for a second. I was looking at verse 4. The discussion back there in Revelation chapter 8, 6 and 7, and also what we said in Revelation 9, 1 and 2, lays the groundwork for what we have here. The smoke. We've already talked about that. And what's the smoke represent? All right, we've got the devil out there trying to, you know, confuse things and trying to go ahead and keep people from seeing the truth, right? So John builds on that. He describes the falsehoods of Satan in verse 2. Now we have the locusts coming out of the smoke. Think about what we've learned. The smoke represents what? The falsehood, the air of the devil. And now you have these locusts, this great force, this strong power. Joel 1, Joel 2. What would the locusts represent?
Well, look to me like this.
All right, that's true. That's true. But these locusts that are involved in the destruction, what would the locusts represent?
False teacher.
All right, they're going to represent the servants of the devil, whether that could be a false teacher or whoever it is. And you have several of these creatures. You think about the locusts, we said 2,000-mile area, square area, just covered with them. Well, that's also true for Satan's helpers, isn't it? They're all across the world. Lots of them. And, you know, you might be able to knock off a few of the locusts. You know, stamp on them and, you know, kill them, but there's always going to be plenty left. That's also true for Satan's helpers. Even if you know, knock off one or 10 or 12, and we're not talking about killing people, but if you're able to go ahead and somehow defeat them, there's always going to be another horde that's not very far away. Now, notice this little point. There in 3, he says, and power was given them. Well, how could you relate that to other truths that we find in the New Testament? We're talking about the powers of evil, Satan's forces, and he says power was given to them. Who do you think gave them the power?
God.
Now, why would he do that? God says to these evil people, I'm going to give you power.
To hurt the people that are trying to destroy his word?
Okay, but why? That's right, but why would God give them power? Maybe we could use the word allowed. Why did God allow these people to have power?
Yes.
It goes back to free will and choice, doesn't it? If evil did not exist, we'd basically be robots. So God says, for Satan and his helpers, if you want to go down this road, if you want to reject me, I will allow that. If you want to go out there and tempt and test and try to hurt people, God says, at least in some respects, I'll give you the key. I'll let you unlock the source. The same kind of deal. Right. Right. In that particular case, it was pretty much he opens up the whole vault and says, you can do whatever you want, just don't take his life. And, you know, when the devil has that kind of power over you, I mean, you want to die. So you're right. And now that power has been restricted in many respects. Then he also uses the word hurt. As you look at verse 4, and we're not ready for that yet, but we will read it. And it was said unto them that they should not what?
Hurt.
So when we think about this power that's been given to the locusts and the smoke that's coming up, I mean, when we think about Satan and his helpers, they're out to hurt. They're out to destroy. They're out to inflict injury, not only on people, but also as we look at the scriptures, we think about man's property. Now, a lot of good illustrations are available for this. We think about, you know, Satan inhabiting people and all the other things that he did. Sometimes he, you know, possessed small children. But one of the things that comes to my mind as far as the devil is Luke chapter 8, verses 27 through 29. Was that right? That was the hurt. And then Luke chapter 8, verses 32 and 33 as well. In 32, now there was the herd of many swine feeding on the mountain. And they entreated him that he would give them leave to enter into them. And he gave them leave. And the demons came out from the man and entered into the swine. And the herd rushed down the steep into the lake, and they were drowned. A lot of people blame God for that. I'm not quite sure that that's putting the blame at the right spot. Here was some property. And it was destroyed. Who's in the business of destroying stuff? It's the devil. So when people have property destroyed, and once again we can look at the Northeast, you think that's discouraging to them? It's a tornado, it's an earthquake, it's something else that comes in and just wipes out their stuff. Yeah. And for a lot of people, what do they think concerning God when they go through that kind of loss? That's right. Both of you got the right answers. Doesn't he love me? Doesn't he care? Where is he? All these things. So Satan, when we think about who he is, what he is, his will for man, he's interested in hurting people. Revelation chapter 9, verse 4. So a lot of Satan's work is designed to make men miserable instead of causing premature death. Now God would hope and does hope that people will repent, that they will seek redemption and salvation, but he does allow the devil to do his will. Now sometimes, and Revelation 9 would be a good chapter for this, sometimes people say, well, why does God allow evil in the world? Well, that's a good question. What's the answer from Revelation 9? It gives people a choice. There is evil in the world, there's righteousness in the world. And they are both in extreme forms. God says, when it comes to righteousness, I've given my son. When it comes to evil, I've given the devil power to go out there and mislead and deceive and involve people in all kinds of sins. And here you are, you're in the middle, you get to choose. Anything you want to ask before we pick up with Revelation 9:4? Sherman?
Maybe you covered it.
Okay.
The mention of scorpions here, is that even make it even greater, because the locust destroys them, but the scorpion
affects pain. We're going to get to that. So I'm just going to ask you to hold on to that, and if we don't cover it thoroughly enough, go ahead and raise your hand again. Okay. Let's pick up with verse 4. And it was said unto them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only such men as have not the seal of God on their foreheads. Okay. Let's see. That was the scorpions. Thank you. I thought that was in there. We're not told why John used the image of scorpions, but I think that when anybody ever been stung by a scorpion?
No.
Okay. I went back and actually did a little reading about scorpions, and you know, a lot of people, Arizona, Texas, you'll find them in those kinds of southern states. And scorpion stings are usually not deadly. But they will go ahead and leave you in a great deal of pain. Fairly common for people to go to the emergency room for that, and they say that that is a horrible, horrible thing. You never came across that in Oklahoma, did you, Joshua?
I haven't brought on anyone that's been stung, but I have seen some wild scorpions.
Okay.
Creepy, but no, I've never.
Okay. All right, so Josh has heard about it a little bit, as have we all. And when you think about that, you're not going to die from it, but it's that, you know, constant pain, that constant biting. And we'll see a little bit more about them a little bit later. But here, it reinforces the point. What does Satan want to do? Not necessarily kill you. Let's just torture him. Let's just go ahead and make life miserable for him. Let's cloud the thinking out there, and let's make life just as awful as it can for people. Well, if that's his plan, who wants to be on that side of the fence? Nobody should. But for the unsaved, as we'll see in verse 4, they have not the seal of God on the forehead. This is Satan's plan. So thanks for that note, Sherman. And like I say, we should talk a little bit more about that as we get further into the text. All right. The green grass, we've already talked about what that represents. You recall?
Christians.
All right, Christians, especially Christians who are... All right, yeah, we've got Christians that maybe are new, in contrast to the trees. Don't hurt the green grass, neither any green thing, neither any tree. We use some Old Testament references to show that trees would also refer to God's people, Christians. But in this case, in contrast to the grass, the trees would be like a strong, mature, a Christian who's really well-rooted. But a lot of times, you know, with green grass, maybe, you know, one of God's people is a little weaker than someone that would have that strong Christian maturity. All right, Satan and his helpers, we saw from the first three verses, they're in the world, they're working, they're like scorpions that want to sting people. But now John says, as the devil is out there doing his work, he says, you can't go after the green things, that is, God's people. Who can you go after there at the end of verse 4? Only those that don't have the seal of God. Well, who would they be?
The unsaved.
Those who have the seal of God would be the righteous. So if you're going to go out there and try to cloud the thinking, if you're going to go out there and try to injure and destroy people, God said my people are in many respects off limits. We said before that a lot of what's in Revelation is simply information that's stated elsewhere in the New Testament. Is just presented in Revelation with figurative language. Now let's think for a second about another verse. James 4:7. Resist the devil and he's going to flee from you. Well, why would that be true? Because God has told the devil and his helpers, hey, as you're out there working in the world, when it comes to my folks, hands off. There are going to be some things that you are not allowed to do to my people. There's a hedge. There's protection around them. So as far as a comforting verse in the book of Revelation, this is certainly one of the comforting verses. Scott?
9:42 made me think of when Revelation first starts out, it says the angels want to back the moral winds and not to arm the world of man. Is that like with this too? Or?
You you do have God. He's active in his world. There are some things that he allows. There are some things that he doesn't allow. And you've got the same kind of thing, but especially with God's people. In 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 19, Paul said, the Lord knows who are his. Well, you think that's just idle knowledge? God says, well, he's one of my people. No, God says, I know he's one of my people. And Satan, hands off him. If you want to tempt him, if you want to do this, you're going to have to go through me. Then Peter, also 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 9, talked about how God is able to deliver the godly out of temptation. Let's go back and pick up some references quickly from the book of Exodus. I want to show you how this principle is not a principle that's really introduced in the New Testament. It's found in the Old. Exodus 8:22. Who wants to take that one for us? Exodus 8, verse 22. Steve, and then Scott, we'll ask you to pick up Exodus 9, verse 4. Steve, we'll ask you to pick up Exodus 9, 6. And then Exodus 9, verse 26. There was another hand on my left. Who would like to take that? Exodus 9, verse 26, Betty. And then one more. Exodus 10, 23. Exodus 10, verse 23, Lois. All right, let's start with Exodus 8, verse 22.
And in that day, I will set apart the land of Goshen in which my people dwell, that no swarms of flies shall be there, in order that you may know that I am the Lord in the midst of the land.
Okay, the land of Goshen. So you should be familiar with the fact that Goshen is in the Bible. And on this particular occasion, God said, when this plague comes upon the land, the people in Goshen will not be plagued by what? The flies. Was God able to deliver his people from this plague? Yes. Same principle that we see in Revelation chapter 9. All right. Revelation 9, or Exodus 9, verse 4.
But the Lord will make a distinction between the livestock of Israel and the livestock of Egypt, so that nothing of all that belongs to the people of Israel.
How interesting. God says, concerning the livestock, I'm going to make a distinction. I'm going to make a division between the two. He does the same today. Glenda?
Kind of like Laban and Jacob, the goats.
Yes. Yeah. You've got the same kind of thing as far as you talked about the speckled and so forth. So God knows who his people are, and he's very, very protective of them. All right, then verse 6 of Exodus 8.
The next day the Lord did it. All the livestock of the Egyptians died, but not one animal belonging to Israelites died.
So God makes a promise. Verse 6, God fulfills the promise. All right, Exodus 8, verse 26.
Only in the land of Goshen were the children of Israel, where the children of Israel were, there was no land.
Was that?
Yeah,
8, I need 8:26, I'm sorry.
8:26.
Uh-huh. I may have. Well, maybe I give you the. I'm going to look at that.
9:26 is only in the land of Goshen where the children of Israel were. There was no hay.
Okay, maybe I wanted 9:26 then. I think I.
That's 9:26.
Okay, thank you. My apologies for that. And then 10:23, Lois.
They did not see one another, nor did anyone rise from his place for 3 days. But all the sons of Israel had light in their dwellings.
Okay. And I think that reference, and one of the reasons I included this one, was because of the east coast, as far as the devastation from the storm. No light for these folks, but God says, for my people, can I take care of the light? Yeah. So the distinction that we see in Revelation 9 is throughout the Exodus plagues and found elsewhere in the New Testament and Old as well. All right, then verse 4 in Revelation 9 is also instructive for this point. We talked a while back about the 144,000 back in Revelation chapter 7. And notice this, and it was said unto them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree. But who can they hurt?
Only those
who have not the seal of God. All right? Who are the sealed?
Christians.
Well, in the 144,000 of Revelation 7, right? So John says in Revelation 9:4, if you're not among the sealed, if you're not among the 144,000, what can the devil do to you? Basically, go after you big time. Now, do you see how that can be helpful in discussing the 144,000? Person shows up on the doorstep and says, hey, there's only 144,000 people, literally, that can be in a right relationship with God. If you really believe that, then what's true of everybody else? Well, they're in Satan's clutches, are they not? Because they're not among the sealed. And I've never used that argument with a witness, but I'm anxious to try it out. So, somebody knocks on your door this week, and they're from that particular organization, you can say, I've got a question for you about the 144,000. Is it literal? Oh, yes. Revelation 9, verse 4. It'll be interesting to see how they respond to that. All right, another quick point, and then we'll pick up with a little information from verses 5 and 6. A quick point about the devil not being able to hurt God's people that also involves the consequences of sin. We haven't laid out how exactly this works. In some respects, though, I would suggest to you that it's based on common sense, and it's based on God's providence. If you have someone out there in the world that's, you know, sleeping around with folks, you think they might pick up some problems because of that? AIDS, all kinds of STDs. But if a person has chosen to follow God, what's going to be true? You're not going to have to worry about that. The unsaved, they decide to go out on a drinking binge Friday and Saturday night. You think there might be some consequences for that sin? Might rack up the car? Might lose an eye? Might kill somebody? But for the Christian who comes along and says, hey, this is God's will, when it comes to alcohol, that's not going to be something that I pursue. You think he's going to free himself or avoid the consequences of that? Sure. So there is kind of an inbuilt protection system for the Christian just by following God's word. So God, it seems to me, also does some supplemental things. So when we do our part and God does his part, between the two, we come out very, very well. And for Satan, it's basically hands off. Talking. That's true. There can be some fallout, if you will. There can be some effects because others are somehow involved in some kind of activity. So we're still in the world. There, I guess I might liken it to an insurance policy. If you think about the folks, going back to the people on the eastern part of the United States, you know, if they have insurance, are they going to suffer some?
Yeah.
You know, you might be out $1,000, maybe $5,000, maybe even $10,000. But it's a whole lot better to be out a few thousand than to say our house was $250,000 and there was no insurance and bang, we're completely broke. So we recognize that principle, and it seems to me that in the spiritual realm, God operates by that same basic principle. He says, I'm not going to take care of every deductible. You know, you're still going to have to face some things. But it's not going to be the kind of catastrophic loss that would be like having everything wiped out and no insurance. So, and that's designed to test us and do some other things. But with some of the fallout, you're right. We do face that. You're exactly right. Scott?
Well, when God's in shooting, he's coming like a thief in the night. We don't know when he's coming, just like we don't know when we'll be followed.
Right. Yeah. So we're faithful during those times, as well as the good times. Okay, let's at least read verses 5 and 6. Because that'll kind of prepare us for what we need next week. And it was given them that they should not kill them, but they should be tormented 5 months. And their torment was as the torment of a scorpion when it striketh a man. And in those days men shall seek death and shall no wise find it. And they shall desire to die, and death flees from them. Now one of the keys to help us understand this is the number 5. Do you remember what we said about the number 10? What's 10 symbolize or represent? Completeness. All right, so if we go from 10 to 5, what does that suggest? We've gone from completeness now to incompleteness. So when John talks about this persecution, if you will, this hostility, they should be tormented for 5 months. I don't think that we're dealing with 150 days. But going back to what numbers mean, they're going to be tormented in such a way, and we're still talking about the unsaved, remember, he talks about them at the end of verse 4. This torment is such where, as we introduce with the scorpion, it's not going to kill you, but it is going to make life very unpleasant. It's going to be very difficult. So, a couple of images there to say, unsaved people, they're going to experience the physical consequences of sin, and they're probably still going to get through life, but it's going to be very, very difficult. Now, if you look ahead a little bit, in verse 19, and at the end of the chapter, John's talking about the spiritual consequences that people face for rejecting God. He says, for the power of the horse is in their mouth and in their tails. For their tails are like, not unto scorpions. But he says, now, in talking about the spiritual consequences, he says, serpents or snakes. Well, they're different kinds of snakes, but what do you think about the snake here? Probably poisonous or not? I'd say poisonous. So John says physical consequences is going to be like a scorpion. It's going to bite. But when we start talking about the spiritual consequences of sin, it's going to be like that rattlesnake. When that gets you, when that bites you, you're going to die. You're going to destroy the spiritual part of your life. Okay, let's see if we can make another quick comment or two before we have to pull it out today. Satan has, we talked about this at the beginning of the class, a significant amount of power, but once again, not enough power to take away a person's choice as far as right or wrong, light or darkness. People are allowed to sow the seeds of sin, if you will, and then, of course, they're going to reap those consequences sometimes for a long, long time. What we see, as far as the information in verse 6, and even there in verse 5, in those days men shall seek death and shall no wise find it. They shall desire to die and death flees from them. Do you think there are times in the lives of the unsaved, because of what they've done, the consequences of sin bring about a state where they wish to die?
I think so.
Yeah. You see the person who's involved with drugs? You find the person who's involved with alcohol. You find the person who's gone to jail. You find the person who's gone to prison. You find the person who's down there on Skid Row. They wish that their life was over. And sometimes life is so miserable for them, they'll kill themselves. So what John is talking about here is exactly right. So we want to say a little bit more about these verses, but I will kind of end it here, and then we'll say some more, I think, about the scorpion next week. Our world, when we think about helplines and crisis centers, suicide prevention centers, we have a hotline for almost every kind of problem that we can imagine. Why is that? It's right here. The problems that come from sin, the people who reject God, it leaves them in a state which is very, very unpleasant. And our world illustrates that on every hand. And this point has been in the Bible for a long, long time. Anything that you want to